Accession number 18481, Reel 1.
Len Bradfield, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Thornton Heath in Surrey.
Which year was this?
In 1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Thornton Heath?
No, I went to Wallington in Surrey, where I grew up, alongside Croydon Aerodrome. And that was my initial fascination with aircraft.
How did you become fascinated by aircraft?
Well, as a child, of going and watching them. Because it was just a case of walking about a quarter of a mile and watching the aircraft take off from Croydon Aerodrome.
How old were you when you left school?
15.
In 37?
Yes.
What did you do on leaving?
I joined my father in the building business. And then I went on to the LCC School of Building to get the Institute of Builders qualification, but the war intervened, and I went into aircrew.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, and I was on Hengistbury Head by Bournemouth at the time. And it was on a portable radio, which was quite a unique thing at the time.
You were on holiday, were you?
Yes.
What was your reaction to the news?
Well, it was relief. I was expecting it because I'd been digging trenches in 1938 on Clapham Common.
How had you come to be digging the trenches?
Well, we were called as volunteers from the School of Building.
That was the Munich crisis?
Yeah.
How did you feel about the Munich crisis?
Well, we thought we'd done the wrong thing. We thought we should have gone to war then. We'd benefit of hindsight to see it wasn't so.
Did you really think that a war would break out in 38?
Oh, yes. I thought we'd have to go to the assistance of the Czechs. You see, we got the Spanish War going on at the time, and we were all very incensed about the Nazis and all the fascist threat. And being students, of course, we were leftish anyway.
Were you a member of a political organisation?
No.
Were you associated with a political organisation? Which one?
Communists.
But you didn't join the Communist
No.
Party?
It was only the fact that we've got all this propaganda about the fascists. I never liked the actual concept of communism. It's a case of anti-fascist was the operation.
Why did you not join some other left-wing organisation apart from the communists?
Well, it was a case of just where you were as a student at the time. You're only talking about 16, you see. I mean, you're very naive at 16.
But did you have communist friends in Wallington?
No, only at Brixton at the School of Building.
Who were there, can you remember?
Not offhand, no.
But did you go on demonstrations and that type of thing?
We used to go in there as backup. I mean, we were quite prepared to fight if need be.
Fight where?
A street fight.
Against?
Fascists. The people who are selling the black shirt, I mean, you'd be quite prepared to move in and, if necessary, thump them. I mean, it was as simple as that.
Did you get into any fights with them?
Not serious fights, just the odd sort of street skirmish.
What did that consist of?
Fists.
So you were in some punch-up?
Yeah.
Who did the punching? You or the opponents?
Well, it was a case of you'd tell them to move on, they wouldn't move on, you'd thump them in the solar plexus, you see, it was as simple as that.
What were they doing, selling a newspaper?
Well, usually selling something like the black shirt or whatever.
Whereabouts was this?
This was either in Brixton or in Croydon.
Do you remember the streets where they used to do it?
Acre Lane in Brixton.
So were they, did they do it, the selling as individuals or as groups?
As groups. That's why you had to have backup, you see. One person would go in and tell them to clear off. They'd possibly assault or attempt to assault the person who'd gone to tell them, and two or three of us would move in, and that would be it.
Who won the fights?
Well, generally we did, because we usually had numbers. You see, they had the disadvantage, they were dressed up as black shirts. We were just in ordinary plain clothes.
So they were distinguishable?
Yeah.
Was there much danger in doing this?
Not really. It was a case we didn't like fascists, so I mean, that was it.
Did you get injured ever?
Well, the only sort of normal bruising that you get from an exchange.
And you said this was in Brixton and where?
In Croydon.
How, when would this have been? What kind of date?
This is 1938, 1938-39.
In the winter?
Yeah, when we were more or less expecting something nasty to happen next springtime.
Were the black shirts strong in Croydon and Brixton?
They were quite strong in Brixton.
But not in Croydon?
Well, they were in certain parts of Croydon, but of course they had quite a large Jewish population in Croydon.
Which parts of Croydon were they strong in?
That was round about Whitehorse Road.
Did you know any of them personally?
No.
What kind of youths were they? Or men?
Pardon? Which?
What kind of men were they?
What, the fascists?
Yes.
Generally speaking, working class who were feeling a bit dispossessed, and the fact that they had no money and the Jews had money. It was simple as that. It was straightforward envy.
Now, coming back to the war, were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
I was at Croydon when it had initial.
Can you tell me what you remember about the bombing of Croydon in detail, please?
Well, only the virtually a Stuka attack on Croydon Aerodrome, as it was, when they hit the bourgeois scent factory and set that on fire, which was part of the old air disco complex from the First War.
When was this about?
This would be July 40.
Where were you at the time?
Well, I'd come home down. I was working for a firm of civil engineers in Scotland this time, because the School of Building had closed down at the outbreak of war. And I'd gone to a firm of civil engineers in Scotland, but I used to come back every 8 weeks. And I was back on holiday at the 8 weeks when they actually bombed the bourgeois factory.
Did any bombs fall near you?
Not immediately adjacent, no.
Did you feel at all frightened when the attack occurred?
Well, we thought that aerodrome was an obvious target. So we weren't unduly surprised. I mean, in those days, you believed that bombing was accurate. My father was a First World War soldier, so I mean, he was also accustomed to fire, wasn't particularly bothered, and was also in fire service. We joined the fire service as well at the time, as well as being a builder. So he was kept right busy.
Did you visit the site of the bombing?
Yes, well, it's a case of just cycling over and having a look, you know.
Did you have to give a hand?
Well, we did a bit of assistance on clearing up, but I mean, everybody did that sort of thing at the time, moving stuff out of the way, but you didn't go in anywhere for two reasons. One, if you go in a building, it can collapse on you, and B, you could be accused of looting, so it's just...
Did looting occur?
Was all suspected. I never heard any actual hard and fast cases, no.
What did the scene look like when you got there?
Well, just fire and general structural damage, you know.
Did you see any casualties?
No. By the time we got there, that was sort of, the place was virtually empty. People had cleared out from the factory. Basic trouble, they got a whole lot of alcohol in store, you see. Being a perfume factory, I think the Germans thought they got something really special, but it was mainly the perfume factory that went up.
The alcohol went up in flames?
Yeah.
Did it shock you or surprise you that such a thing should happen?
No. I mean, at that age, nothing surprises you.
What other bombing events do you remember in the Blitz?
Bombing of Croydon High Street. I remember that going through there on trolley bus when there was glass everywhere. But that's about all of that.
When did that occur?
Well, that would be one of the... when I came back from Scotland, it would be about another 8 weeks sort of business, you know. Each time you came back, you seemed to be coming into air raids.
What had you gone to Scotland for?
I was working for a civil engineering company building coke oven plants.
What was your address in Wellington?
2 Redford Avenue, which ran up to the old aerodrome. It had been cut by the aerodrome.
Did any bombs fall near that residence?
Yeah, well, the house opposite was destroyed. But not while I was there.
Did you find the bombing at all frightening in the Blitz?
No, it's sort of... Well, it's like any other combat situation. You hope it doesn't hit you, you know. It's just... And it's not, you can't do anything, you're there. I mean, that's it, there's no point in panicking.
Did you take shelter?
Oh, yes.
In what?
Well, we actually had to have got a shelter.
Your own personal?
Yeah.
What kind of shelter was that?
Brick. My father had built that in the garden.
Did you feel safe in that?
Oh, yes, well, it was a fact he'd been a sapper in the First War, and we got a good idea. Good idea of making place splinter-proof, you know, nice lot of earth on top of it.
Oh. How did your parents react to the Blitz?
Well, it was only my father. I lost my wife, my mother in 1936.
How do you think public morale stood up to the bombing?
I thought very well. I think they didn't believe it could happen to us, that we would be successful. We were the British Empire, on which the sun never sets, and all would be well.
Were you at that time a patriotic person or not?
Oh, we were fighting for Britain, and we were completely against the fascists. We were going to free Europe from the fascists. That was the whole object of the exercise.
What particularly, specifically about fascism did you object to?
Well, it was the regimentation, really. And the thing that I think unified Britain against the Nazis more than anything else was the Nuremberg rallies.
What specifically about them?
Well, the marching and the banners and all the rest of it. The fact they'd made a jolly good show of it, you know, it was too perfect.
How do you mean too perfect?
Well, everything, all the troops were marching in absolute precision. All the right sizes, you didn't get a little short one in the middle, you know. They got everything so perfect, you absolutely hated them for it.
No individuality?
I think that's the basic point, isn't it?
So it was Nazism in Germany rather than Mussolini's version.
Well, we always thought Mussolini was rather a joke.
Coming back to the bombing, what attitude did the bombing of South London create towards the German aircrews who were carrying out the bombing?
There was a degree of hostility, but I mean, it was a case of they were accepted as being actual part of the machine. We didn't regard them as individuals. There was never a case of any lynching or any of that sort of attitude. I think the older generation regard them as rather sick of letting the Führer push them into it, which was precisely the same situation as we were going to be in later, of course.
Can we come on now to your joining up, please?
Well, I joined up in end of 1940. And
volunteering for aircrew?
I had to volunteer for aircrew because I was in a reserved occupation.
Was it difficult to get out of being...
It was. So I was working as a draftsman with the draftsman surveyor up on site with the building these coke oven plants.
So how did you get out of it?
Well, once you told your boss that you were interested in going to fight, he thought, well, he would be better release you because you obviously were not going to be keen on working on the site as a reserved occupation because, I mean, you were definitely getting the white feather sort of syndrome at the time. You know, the girls thought it was a bit odd that you would sort of be soldiering on at your age rather than going and fighting the wicked Nazis.
Did you ever get any white feathers?
No, that goes back to the First War, but I mean, you got the feeling it was about there.
From comments?
Well, people were quite surprised that you were still there, you know.
Did you ever get any comments?
No.
Why did you want to go in for RAF aircrew?
Well, I thought it was the best way of getting it back at the Germans. And, I mean, I got that my education was such that I was going to be a surveyor or architect. So I thought, well, my mathematics would be good enough to get me into aircrew, so I went into it. I did actually believe I could do a better job as aircrew than I could do as my civilian job.
So how did you go about joining up?
Well, we applied through the usual channels. You know, there was recruiting offices that you could actually contact. I think it was the Department 11 of the Air Ministry one wrote to. We got the forms and then I was interviewed. And this was all done in Scotland. And I went up and was sworn in at the Usher Hall.
Where's that?
In Edinburgh.
What was the next step?
Well, I was then put on deferred service. So I left my firm in Scotland and went back and joined my father, who was... doing the bomb damage repairs, and worked on with him, waiting for my actual call-up. Because when I actually had been accepted, I was just sacked by the firm. Because it was more of a breach of the... I wasn't Article 2. I mean, it was a case of it being in a similar situation to Articles, but not formally Articled.
So when were you called to the colours?
41.
Do you remember the month?
Not offhand, no. I think it must have been about September, I think.
Had you been in any more bombing by then?
Yes, I'd done well, been working round bombing. Well, we've been going on bomb damage repairs in Penge and Lewisham, and nearer in to London than Croydon. And we'd seen an awful lot of repair work to be done, but this was basically a case of filling in broken windows, temporary roofing and that sort of thing. Wasn't very dramatic, but it was used to have very long and very hard days at that.
Because of the rush to get...
Yeah, repair. We've got to get the stuff up, you know. We were working roughly from about 7 in the morning till, well, dark at night.
This was your father's own firm, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How many men did he have?
About 30 at the time. And they were all ages, mainly of the First War generation.
I wonder they could cope with it then.
Well, I mean, they beavered on. They were only about 40, 50 at the time. I mean, they weren't old men.
Now, coming back to the RAF, where did you do your basic training?
Well, we went to Aircrew Reception Centre at Regent's Park. Then we went to Scarborough to initial training wing up there. We did the initial training and then we came out as LACs. I then went to, I was on for pilot training at the time. I went on to grading school at Codsall at Wolverhampton, where I did about 8 hours on Tiger Moth, but didn't pass out. We then got regraded and sent off for observer training to Manchester, to ACDW, as they called it. But then they said that we could go as air bombers, a new trade that was going to be brought in, which would save a lot of time. We went out on and started out on navigation training, and then latterly, when we were at Bobington, they actually brought the air bomber grade in, and those that were above average at bombing went as air bombers. Those were above average for navigation, carried on as navigators, because at that time we were being trained as observers. But it all got us a bit of a pickle there, because this business about being an air bomber, you've got the same money, but you were had got this very much restricted trade of actually aiming the bombs, doing visual navigation, and all that went with that, and also being the front gunner.
So an air bomber was a bomb aimer?
Yeah.
And is that what you became?
Yeah. That was what I was flying as. I was trained as a navigator bomb aimer, as an observer. Then they split the trade when we were coming out at Bobington.
And how were you supposed to do the job as a bomb aimer? Can you take me through the process, step by step, what you actually did in the plane?
Well, you're actually responsible for setting the... You've got the actual bomb load. You have to set that out of how it's going to be dropped. You've then got your actual bomb aiming equipment. You've got to go and find the wind so you can get the drift on it. So that involves taking drifts one way or another, either with the bomb sight or however, and get a cocked hat and get a wind for the height. That also helps with the navigation, because you would be checking these winds at regular intervals of taking drifts and getting the wind. Then on the at the target, you would have your bomb sight set up for the actual terminal velocity of your principal weapon. Then you'd have the actual timing device to release the bombs in order, so that would lead the principal weapon to arrive in the middle of the stick. Now, the stick would be about 700 yards long. The operation then was, you got the information of the wind, you've got the altitude which came off your altimeter, which would be fed into the this is on Lancaster at the latter stages with the Mark 14 bomb site, which was a semi-automatic computer which you fed the information of bomb load, etc., etc., in, and then that transmitted onto a graticule which was projected onto a gyro-stabilized a glass plate that you had the lamp projecting an image on, which you could push forward and reach the target, and you'd watch the target coming up into this, and you keep on left, left, right, steady, left, left, to bring the target under the bomb site. And at the crucial moment, you'd let the bomb go as soon as the crosshairs of the graticule crossed the actual aiming point, which may well be air or ground markers, as it was in my time, but beforehand you'd do that just on a dark target.
How do you take a drift?
Well, that is a case of you get either have a smoke float drop going over the North Sea and the rear gunner takes it, or you pick up some light object and watch, bring your bomb sight over to that and watch that float through. And you keep on doing that on anything that you could actually sight on. Because the navigator's also got his track made good, and he can work out the wind with checking with your drift that you're giving him. Because as the aircraft is travelling forward at about 180 knots, and you've got a drift from wind of about 30 knots, you've got quite a measurable deviation between the two, and it's quite easy to ascertain how fast the wind is, whether it's 30 knots or 20 knots or whatever.
And you had to do this on every raid?
Oh, yes. In fact, you'd do it several times on a raid if you got anything to just checking, it was capable of checking a drift on to make sure you got a good one when you got there. Because the exercise was always very responsible, I always felt very responsible for the fact that the other six was going to all this trouble to get me there to get the bomb on the target.
What were these light objects which were dropped?
Well, the flame floats used to drop in the North Sea for the rear gunners to take a drift on, but the things we used to pick up were any form of anything that shone, really, like rivers or anything like that, you could pick up and work a drift out from.
What instruments did you use to...
That's the bomb sight. You just track him over and pick him up, and then he would actually... You'd hold him and you could read the actual angle that he was out at. And you'd be talking over about... Well, we're talking about 15, 20 seconds.
Now, coming back to your training, can you take me further through your training, please?
Well, we went to... Once we come out that we were going to be observers, we came out and went to Bridge North, and we did... I think it was 6 weeks navigation training there. Then we went to Bobbington, where we did... that was Air Observer School, where we were actually doing bits and pieces.